This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And it's probably not surprising for you to learn that gun theft is a significant problem in this country. It is hard to determine exactly how many weapons are boosted each year, but at least one report from the FBI estimates 1.8 million firearms were stolen from individuals between the years 2012 and 2017. And the ATF estimates approximately 54,000 more were stolen from gun stores during that time period. It's a serious problem, and one that has prompted news you can use, local reporting, like this segment from CBS 46 in Atlanta last week.
There is a way to make sure a criminal doesn't end up with your gun. Don't leave it in your car.
If your firearm absolutely has to be inside of your vehicle, you want to invest in a lockbox or a safe. Tie it to the trunk, but do not leave a firearm inside your vehicle.
Okay, I'm not really sure what's going on with the morning commute in Atlanta that makes it absolutely necessary to keep a firearm in your car, but okay. Now that said, there is one place where it indisputably makes sense for us to keep weapons. Military bases. Marines have a pile of Colt 9mm? Cool. Navy has a room full of M16s. Seems fine. Marine locker with a M4 semi-automatic? Do you, son. The presence of heavy armaments is core to the very definition of the armed services, but what is surprising to learn is that the U.S. military may need a little refresher on gun safety, PSA style. Here's our old friend, McGruff the Crime Dog, back in 2014.
Never let your gun get into the wrong hands. If you own a firearm and are not using it, please be responsible and be sure that it's stored in a safe place.
It is, in fact, reasonable to assume military custody is a safe place for weapons. But a new investigation from the Associated Press found that around 1,900 military weapons were either lost or stolen during the past decade. That number includes more than 1,100 rifles, 694 handguns, 74 machine guns, and 34 rocket launchers. And once they're lost or stolen, these military weapons often resurface in places as close as Albany, New York, or as far away as Afghanistan. Sometimes being used to commit violent crimes. With 34 missing rocket launchers, I'm thinking we're going to need more than McGruff the Crime Dog. Joining me now, hopefully with the coordinates of these missing rocket launchers, is Kristen Hall, a reporter at the Associated Press and one of the journalists who broke the story. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So this is the first public accounting of its kind in decades. How did you and your team go about investigating this?
Well, it was very difficult, and it took us years to do. One reason for that is that the DOD and the military are not required to publicly report this information. That was the case at one point back in the early 90s, as we understand, they were required to report equipment losses to Congress on an annual basis. But when that requirement stopped, public accountability slipped. But that doesn't mean that, you know, incidents and losses didn't keep happening.
So when you all have found it through this difficult multi-year process that 1,900 U.S. military firearms were lost or stolen, are you confident that's the maximum number, or are you thinking that's probably an undercount?
We know that it's an undercount for a number of reasons. For instance, the Air Force gave us no data on how many firearms they have lost or have been stolen. The Army gave the AP a very clear undercount of data that didn't include things like major cases, open cases. And so the AP found internal memos that the Army produced that showed their count of weapons loss was many times higher than what they told the AP.
So what kinds of weapons are most likely to go missing?
Well, I mean, they're the workhorse weapons of the U.S. military. So they're rifles and pistols. These are, you know, they have several million weapons all across the globe. And a lot of these fit into those two categories.
Now, are people within the military themselves taking these? How are they getting out? How are they going missing?
Well, there's sometimes where we understand that insiders, people who work and have access to armories, warehouses, have been accused of taking weapons and weapons parts off post. Maybe they're selling them. Maybe they're making a new weapon out of weapons parts. But a lot of times it's unclear what happens. Records are destroyed, inventories are not taken in a proper way, and investigators are reaching dead ends.
So I suppose if all these weapons ended up in the same place that the left sock ends up after laundry, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But that's not what's happening, right? Where do these weapons end up?
Yeah, it is hard to trace where some of these weapons end up, but we have found a small number that ended up in violent crimes. For instance, we found a military pistol that was tied to four separate shootings in Albany, New York. What's interesting is that when police recovered this Beretta M9, the Army didn't even know that the gun was missing from Fort Bragg.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is just stunning to me. Living in North Carolina, not that far from Fort Bragg, having, friends and family in military, it's always been my experience that, soldiers and Navy folks and Marines, they are serious about weapon safety. This is truly a shocking story to me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly weapons security is drilled into troops from the moment they get into the service. And top military officials say, that it is a very high priority for them to take care of their weapons. But we just found some cases where, troops were sleeping on the job. There's shoddy record keeping, just it's a surveillance camera system that didn't work. And just security lapses.
So if there is meant to be an accountability space, where should the buck stop? Is it with those troops, often young men and women? If they're literally sleeping on the job, it might suggest something about their exhaustion. Or is there someone in the Pentagon who we ought to be holding accountable?
Well, I think transparency would help here in this situation. And, we have seen actually the reaction from Congress to this story was immediate. On Tuesday, Army Secretary Christine Wormuth was asked about whether she would be open to new oversight on weapons accountability. So I do think that having more information about how these cases occur could help solve some of the problems.
So speaking of solving some of the problems, does the military ever recover weapons that have been lost? Or once they're gone, are they just sort of gone forever?
No, they do recover. I mean, in the case of the Navy and Marines, they gave us good information and that included recoveries. So, and a lot of times a gun will go missing and it will immediately be found, within, 24 hours. But sometimes things go missing for several years.
Okay, so let's dig into that for just a second, because I do actually get, I'm disturbed by, but I can get how a handgun might go missing. But for real, grenade and rocket launchers? Now, I know that these are vanishingly small numbers, right? 34, 35 over the course of a decade. But still, I mean, you don't like accidentally leave your rocket launcher, like upstairs beside your bed. Where are the rocket launchers?
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I wish I did. Someone knows where they are.
Yeah, I really would like some. I'm sorry. I am not an alarmist, and I try very hard not to be an alarmist. But I will say that that kind of got to me in a particular way. And I suppose it shouldn't, because we do know that handguns are actually, the most sort of deadly weaponry for civilians. So can you talk to me about how this story of military loss of weapons is connected to sort of our broader guns conversation in this country?
Well, we're certainly not suggesting that the military's firearms, lost firearms, or somehow in, you know, contributing to an increase in gun violence. That's not what we're saying in this story. What we are saying is that a gun that belongs to the military can end up in the hand of felons, and we found several cases of that. So they can be used in crimes. These are weapons sometimes that civilians aren't meant to have. And when they're stolen, when they're taken from somewhere, when they're military property, you know, the people that are using them or want them or buy them are not on the up and up. I mean, we found a case in Fresno, California, where AK-74s were sold to a Fresno street gang. And several of those have not been recovered.
Talk to me also about how this might be not so much about guns, but also about reporting. So part of what I appreciate about what you said in this story is that it took years. It was you and colleagues doing this work. That is a fairly substantial investment of journalistic work, labor hours, to get government accountability, right? It is in certain ways the thing that American media was meant to be in our democracy. And that's happening at the same time that, for example, local papers are closing, and it's harder and harder to get exactly those kinds of reporting resources. Is there something about this story that also helps us understand the stories we may not even realize we're missing because of that sort of loss of reporting resources?
Well, I mean, I certainly, over the years that I was looking at this story or looking at this idea and trying to ask questions of the Army, you know, I got told no several times. You know, we're not going to give you that information. We're not going to give you these records. You know, I mean, that is frustrating. And there is a sense of like, oh, I'm just going to move on, you know. But I mean, to me, there's just a curiosity factor. You know, I was seeing these cases of troops getting arrested and stealing things. And I just, you know, knew that somebody had the answers. There's information. I mean, the military counts a lot of things, has a lot of things to count. So, you know, I think there's just a persistence there of saying, no, there is numbers, there are numbers that you can provide. And to me, I think there is there's a accountability to the public that needs to happen, because these weapons are not meant to be put on the streets or used in street crimes. They're meant to protect us.
Mm. Kristen Hall, I so appreciate that response. In many ways, it is journalism 101. I was curious, I was consistent, and I knew that data was out there, so I kept going until I got it. Kristen Hall is a reporter, and a good one, at the Associated Press. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Started with 7, got up to 10, then make 10. You look around, it's 18. When it got up to 40, it got up to 50. And after that, you have 60 guys and one wing had corona.
You're listening to the voice of Ronnie Lauderdale, a 63-year-old married father and grandfather. Incarcerated for a nonviolent crime in a federal facility near Lexington, Kentucky, Mr. Lauderdale faced the COVID pandemic behind prison walls. Without access to personal protective equipment and unable to maintain physical distance from others, Mr. Lauderdale, who is diabetic, soon contracted the virus.
I got to coughing. I was coughing real bad. Well, I couldn't stop, like something was in my throat. And then the fever started. Once the fever started, I began to have cold chill at night and break out in a cold sweat. And the taste bud had completely went away, so I could stop eating.
Late last year, Mr. Lauderdale told his story as part of the project If Prison Walls Could Talk from the Vera Institute for Justice.
It was close to 2 months before my wife realized I had corona. They turned the phones off, so no one could talk to their family.
Ronnie Lauderdale survived coronavirus, and he credits fellow inmates who banded together to care for one another when it felt as though they'd been abandoned to perish. Now, after his ordeal, Mr. Lauderdale filed an appeal for compassionate release, which was finally granted by a judge. But the getting out part, that's the part of his story that is very rare. Recent reporting from the Marshall Project and The Guardian reveals just how rare. According to their reporting, 31,000 people imprisoned in federal facilities sought compassionate release as the deadly virus engulfed the ill-equipped federal prison system. The Bureau of Prisons approved only 36. 36. While 49,000 federal prisoners fell ill from the virus and 256 perished. With me now is Carrie Blakinger, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Carrie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we jump into the numbers you've been reporting, can you talk to us a little bit about what are the different ways that people were able to be released from Bureau of Prison facilities during the pandemic?
Well, there's two main ways. One is home confinement, and the other is compassionate release. And home confinement, technically the person is still an inmate, and they've just been sent to finish their sentence at home. That's a decision that's entirely up to the Bureau of Prisons. And now, as the pandemic seems to be coming to a close, those people might have to come back to prison. The more permanent way to get out is compassionate release, which is when you ask the prison system to, you know, recommend you to get out. And as I reported, most of the time they deny that. And then you have the option to appeal to a judge. And the judges are a little more apt to agree and let someone out. And in those situations, if you get out on compassionate release, like, you are out, your sentence is over, you are no longer an inmate, and they're not going to send you back when the pandemic is over.
Right. I mean, you might still be under some kind of state-based supervision, like parole, but you're not, you've finished your sentence.
You finished your sentence, and there's not parole in the federal system. This is why federal prisoners end up doing a lot higher percentage of their sentence than is often the case in state systems, because there's no parole. There are situations where you can end up in a halfway house, but that's typically the people on home confinement. Usually when you're getting out on compassionate release, unless you're agreeing to do some sort of monitoring as part of your terms of compassionate release, like, you know, you would just be out. Typically, it's called a reduction in sentence because they, like, just end your sentence.
So I think part of what I found most stunning, just relative to the numbers that you all reported, is that the numbers for compassionate release actually went down during the pandemic. So prior to COVID, it was in the, like, mid-50s, and it goes down to the mid-30s. So we're still talking about very small numbers relative to the numbers who are applying for it. But that gap between the number applying and the number who actually are granted it, at least by the Bureau of Prisons, that gap opens during a pandemic.
Yes, I know. It was so shocking. You know, even to me, as someone who reports on this and is thinking about these issues and talking to people day in and day out, even I was surprised by that. And usually when I would tell people, when I would, you know, call people to interview them and tell them about this data, they would say, oh, well, they'd assume I meant as a percentage. They would be like, oh, well, there's more people that applied during the pandemic, so of course it's a lower percent. And I'm like, no, it's raw numbers. Like, the raw number of people that BOP greenlit for release was less after the pandemic, which, you know, is shocking. And like I said, there were far more applications. In 2019, there were about 1,700 people who asked for compassionate release. And, you know, after the pandemic, there's been around 31,000, and yet fewer of those were approved.
Now, why? So again, I know this a bit from having read it, but why is the Bureau of Prisons saying that people are not, can't be released, even though you have somewhat more, a little bit of an uptick in it with judges being willing to release?
You know, we don't get a lot of insight. There are some sort of generic reasons that are included in some of the data that's been released. But, I mean, I think it sort of comes down to that, you know, jailers want to jail. Like, they're not brought up in a culture to be releasing people. And I think that's sort of at the heart of it. But to some degree, this is just speculation, because we only sort of get form answers. We don't get a lot of sort of granular detail until things move into federal court. And then sometimes you get more nuanced discussions from the DOJ as to why they think someone should or shouldn't be released.
Yeah, I think for me, that was part of what was stunning was, you know, we are in the midst of a pandemic. You saw, especially in prisons, these rates increasing dramatically with COVID exposure. And then the Bureau of Prisons didn't have to give a reason.
Right. I will say one of the more appalling reasons when things get into federal court is that oftentimes the DOJ would oppose release, saying that it was safer to leave someone in prison.
Okay. Yeah. So, Carrie, tell me another story. Talk to me about Sean McQuitty and how he exemplifies the problem in this system.
Yeah. So this was a really heartbreaking story to tell. The McQuitty brothers, because they were both sent to prison, Daryl and Sean, they grew up in the projects of Nashville, and they ended up sort of turning to the one reliable source of income that the people around them were doing, which was selling drugs. And they turned out to be quite good at it, ended up running a very successful crack house, and then got arrested in 1997. And Daryl, who was the brother that was in charge of it, got 25 years. But Sean, who worked below him in this, you know, in their crack house, he got a mandatory life sentence because of two times that he had let a 17-year-old work a few hours in the crack house. And throughout their time in prison, the brothers kept in touch by email. They, you know, had these plans for what they were going to do if they could get out someday. And Daryl was going to get out and start a dump truck company and hire Sean to drive for him. And then sentencing reform came along, and Daryl qualified for a shorter sentence because his pre-sentencing report only listed powder cocaine, but Sean's also listed crack. So even though they were both doing these things together, just sort of this fluke of the paperwork, Sean didn't qualify for a sentence reduction and Daryl did. And so Daryl got out in 2015 and they still talked every day and they kept in touch. And, you know, Sean was still trying to get a sentence reduction as well. And, you know, hoped that he was apparently had great faith that he would not die in prison and that he would someday come home. And he applied for compassionate release in August and the warden did not respond. And then they, you know, went to court and the judge had not made a decision by the time that he started coughing in December and called home and told his brother, I don't think I'm going to make it. I have a lot of underlying conditions. And he was like, I love you, but I think I'm, you know, I don't think I'm going to make it. And, you know, then he ended up on a ventilator in the hospital and, you know, his brother went to visit him. It was the second time they'd seen each other in whatever 25 years since the arrest. And, you know, he was chained to a hospital bed and dying. And, you know, he ended up becoming one of the, you know, one of the 200 some federal prisoners who died of COVID.
So, Carrie, tell us, is there something that can be done in the system to create a more fair process, one that preserves more lives?
Yeah, sure. I think that most immediately, the thing that could actually be changed better is home confinement. Compassionate release, there's a lot that could be done with that. But home confinement is the thing that's sort of most immediately pressing because there's a few thousand prisoners that, under the current DOJ interpretation of the CARES Act, would have to come back to prison when the pandemic is over. And if Biden's administration reinterprets that, then those people might not have to come back to prison. So that's something that's sort of been hanging over the heads of, you know, a few thousand prisoners and the legal community for the past few months.
Carrie Blakinger is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Back with you now on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina. Now, last week on the show, we spoke about the decades of discrimination that Black farmers and other farmers of color have experienced in the U.S. The exclusionary policies of the federal government are one important factor that contributed to Black farmers losing 12 million acres of land over the past century. these discriminatory policies are hardly a thing of the past. For example, Black farmers received just 0.1% of the relief funds allocated to farmers under the Trump administration's COVID-19 stimulus packages. And the American Rescue Plan, passed in March, was supposed to finally begin to address these inequalities by offering meaningful debt relief to Black farmers and other farmers of color. When we checked in last week, the plan was finally scheduled to get underway. Until Thursday, when a federal judge placed a temporary restraining order on the program, and the judge sided with a group of white farmers who claimed the debt relief policy discriminates against them. Here's what Lloyd Wright, a farmer and the former director of the USDA Civil Rights Office, told me last week about these types of lawsuits.
For the last 150 years, white farmers have received almost all of the benefits from the Department of Agriculture. And now that we're getting ready to give crumbs to some extent to people of color, American Indians, who they took the land from to begin with, and blacks who cleared the land as slaves for them back generations ago. So now that they're getting ready to give crumbs to minorities, they have ants in their pants. They didn't get concerned 4 years ago when the Trump administration did emergency payments to farmers, and 99%+ of it went to white farmers. I didn't hear about lawsuits then concerned that people of color was not getting money.
Meanwhile, the USDA says that it is defending the debt relief plan despite the temporary hold, and that it plans to continue paying off loans for Black farmers if and when the hold is lifted. For more, I am joined now by Congresswoman Alma Adams, who represents the extraordinary North Carolina 12th District. Representative Adams is also vice chair of the House Committee on Agriculture. Representative Adams, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa. It's good to be with you.
So we had just done this story with Farmer Wright when I then saw the news that the debt relief was being put on hold. I was so hurt and angry. What was your initial reaction to learning this news?
Well, Melissa, I was just devastated. I disagree with the judge's order, but I'm disappointed in the people who brought this misguided lawsuit as well. These borrowers were scheduled to receive the assistance as early as this month. And so this decision is going to delay the recovery for these farmers. And they've suffered and they continue to suffer. And we just need to stay on top of this.
So if you had an opportunity to talk with these plaintiffs, with these white farmers, with the conservative groups who are defending them in court, what might you say to them about this set-aside relief for farmers of color?
Well, first of all, I would talk to them about all of the past discrimination. The fact that, these are farmers who are working to make sure that they provide for their families, to make sure that they're able to stay in business. And I think I would try to at least appeal to whatever sensitivity they have. But I think it's important that we recap the history for people who don't seem to want to recognize it and just kind of put it up in their faces. The discrimination is something that I think we try to ignore. And we've seen it not just with this situation, but with the distribution of funds for historically Black colleges and so forth. And we've got 1890s that actually deal with agriculture in terms of their programs. So I think we have to make it very clear that we have not gotten, not even our fair share. We just have not been treated, these farmers have just not been treated fairly. And that they should, we should be able to appeal to some sensitivity of these white farmers.
The 1890s institutions, those historically Black land grant colleges, and North Carolina A&T is among them, that's in your district. Talk about the history of agriculture associated also with Black education.
Well, thank you, Melissa. And let me just say North Carolina A&T is my alma mater twice. I have been very involved with doing work for our historically Black colleges and universities, and we have 19 1890s. And just as we started HBCUs many years ago because our students that looked like me and you could not attend the major majority culture schools, So in North Carolina, we have a North Carolina A&T, which is an 1890 land grant. There's an 1862 North Carolina State, and we've seen discrimination throughout this process of funding for these schools. They are very much involved with not only doing research, but we have worked through the Agriculture Committee to try to get increased support. As a matter of fact, just recently we did have a hearing on 18 black farmers, and they talked a lot about not only the schools and so forth, but I think that we're going to have to continue. Right now, what we see is that the state is required to match the funding from the federal government to our schools, and that has not been done. Historically, that has not been done. I served 20 years in the North Carolina House, and it seems that we just couldn't find the funding for North Carolina A&T that was a 1-1 match, but yet we were able to match money to North Carolina State 5 and 6 times. So that means to me that it's not a lack of funding, it's a lack of where we put our priorities. And so we've not put the priorities in terms of state government supporting our 1890s. But these schools are valuable, they're important. We are losing black farmers day by day. The number is diminishing. And so we want to keep young people interested in agribusiness and agriculture overall. And that one of the ways to do it is to make sure that we have the funding there to provide scholarships. And the gentleman is right. You can't just give them money today and say, let's produce tomorrow. I mean, we've got to be realistic about it and make sure that the ample time is provided to do all those things that they need to do.
I so appreciate you making that connection, and also that those inequities, not only in what we think of as payments directly to farmers, but to that whole system of college education also associated with those land grants, how many years of inequalities there are. I'm wondering, we also heard from Mr. Wright talking about the possibility of restructuring aspects of the USDA. Given that you are sitting there in a leadership role on the Ag Committee within Congress, is that something that you all have any capacity or power to do?
Oh, yes, we do. We provide oversight to USDA. I've always believed in making sure that we bring the stakeholders to the table, because folks like Mr. Wright, they're out here where the rubber meets the road. They're working day by day, and they're the ones who I think realistically can provide information to us that's helpful. So, you know, it is clear that we do handle the oversight, and including North Carolina A&T. And we've got to make sure that we take the advice of people who actually know this business. And yes, restructuring, you know, you can't keep things as they are just because these particular things have been in existence for many, many years. And just because you know, you always have to go back and revisit and revise. And especially if things aren't working, and certainly they've not been working for our black farmers. So yeah, I would support that. And I think, again, we probably need to have a follow-up hearing and have some discussion about it. But we don't have to just have a hearing to discuss it. But I do think, we have the oversight, and there are many things I think that we can do in terms of holding folks accountable, putting pressure where pressure needs to be put.
Now, I wanted to also just ask you briefly about the legal argument here, because after the American Rescue Plan was passed back in March, you actually cited a 1995 Supreme Court decision and defended the ability of Congress to act on the basis of race to remedy these effects of discrimination. Can you walk us through that just a bit here?
Well, you know, I think race is something that people don't want to talk about as much, but there's a lot going on that shouldn't be. And again, I think we have to, historically, the discrimination has existed. It's still there. The inequities are present. When the lawsuit The ruling poses a question. How are we going to rectify these decades of discrimination and inequities when the law justified that discrimination, but they won't actively work to correct it? And I think we have to hold them accountable to do that. And that's where I think the Congress can come into play here. We've got a lot of work to do. And I think we, you know, we can't let up and just let this continue to go, because we'll never get the problem corrected. But I think with all of the discussion that we're having today, with so many things going on, we're going to have to, race has got to be a part of it. People don't need to get upset and angry about it. It is real. And we have to be realistic about it and try to understand it more. And that's where I think the education is going to have to come into play.
Congresswoman Alma Adams represents North Carolina's 12th congressional district. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa. You keep up the good work.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and who remembers this moment?
And our new Miss America is Vanessa Williams, Miss New York!
That was the night when Vanessa Williams became Miss America 1984, and the first Black woman to wear the crown. I was 10, and I still remember how proud my family and friends were. We loved Vanessa, and we still do. But she was not the first Black beauty queen. Black folk have long traditions of crowning our own queens, from the Queen of Zulu waving at Mardi Gras revelers as she passes, to the queens of historically Black colleges and universities, profiled each year in Ebony magazine. Even just the beauties of the week are queens of a sort. And in many Southern towns, one of the most coveted titles for young Black women is Miss Juneteenth. Filmmaker Channing Godfrey Peoples captured the culture, the drama, the expense, and the expanse of this tradition in her 2020 film, Miss Juneteenth.
Juneteenth is our holiday, where we recognize when the slaves of Texas finally found out they were free. 2 long years after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. The date was June 19th, 1865, now known as Juneteenth. So you see, ladies, not only will you represent your beautiful selves, but our history as well.
So, what does it mean to wear a crown that represents your own beautiful self and the history of a people? Here to help us answer that question is Channing Godfrey Peoples, screenwriter and director of the film Miss Juneteenth. Channing, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Melissa. What a joy to be here with you.
I feel this, you know, Juneteenth, it does kind of give you that feeling like, I don't know how this could not feel joyful. So tell me about the pageants in Fort Worth, Texas, that you grew up attending.
Yeah, it was so interesting because I was listening to your introduction that included Miss America. And I think for me, Miss Juneteenth always felt like my own version of Miss America. It was, you know, really special to me because I think as a young girl, seeing all those young Black women on stage, you know, I felt like there's a line in the film that says, I felt like they were floating, you know, or something like that. Look, I'm misquoting myself, but that's what it felt like to me. It felt like, you know, seeing all these young Black women float across the stage, and they had this sense of like hope and wonder on their faces. And, you know, I know now that it was confidence building for me. It was young women of every shape, size, you know, a variety of skin tones and hair textures. And, you know, as an adult, I realized how special that was. And it makes perfect sense that it, you know, resonates so greatly in my work.
All right. So here's the thing. Those pageants, the Zulu Queen pageant, like all of that, I feel like I have those same gut level memories. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I feel excited that the notion of Juneteenth, the possibilities of its celebration are expanding. There's another part of me that's like, you know what? This is ours. Could we just keep it? Y'all just go some other place. What are we meant to do with how important it really was and is to build internally at the same time that we want to share our history and our culture more broadly?
I have a similar feeling. You know, there's so much that I want to protect about it. I think as a filmmaker, you know, I tend towards, you know, I try to portray stories and characters as authentically as possible. And that was why it was so important for me and Miss Juneteenth to really, you know, focus on the details and the specificity of that particular world. You know, I'm from Fort Worth. I grew up commemorating Juneteenth as a child. You know, it has a different meaning, I think, for me as an adult. You know, as a kid, it was more about the celebration, and the centerpiece of it was the Miss Juneteenth pageant. And that's what I really looked forward to every year. But for me now, it really is about, you know, commemorating. And I don't have all the answers, but I could just say that, you know, I feel like it is something that I want to protect. And I also think it's important for us to focus on the specificity of that particular day. You know, we're honoring the enslaved people in Texas who didn't find out they were free until 2.5 years, you know, late. And I think it's important to keep that in the focus.
So one of the things I love about the specificity, the details of your film, is the mother-daughter relationship in the film. I'm the mother of daughters and the daughter of a mother. And so that tension that's part of it. Can you talk to us a little bit about sort of those aspects of pride, of tradition, of educational scholarship that are all part of the Miss Juneteenth practice?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because I really focused on Turquoise, the lead character, is really based on the women in my life, in the community, in my family, you know, in myself. And but most especially, you know, my mom, she really, you know, I watched her because she was a single woman for much of my life. And I watched her navigate her own dreams while juggling raising children, you know, and there was this sense of grit, you know, the sense of determination. But, you know, I also saw her and the women in my community carry themselves with grace. And that's something that I really, really wanted to bring to the film. You know, I also was exploring like this theme of Juneteenth and what delayed freedom meant for Turquoise as a character. But really, I applied that to each character in the film.
That idea of delayed freedom, that is the tension with Juneteenth, right? That we are celebrating freedom, but it's also, I always feel like, should we be put in a question mark or an exclamation point when we say happy Juneteenth? Because it's also about marking having been lied to for 2 years about being free.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I say happy Juneteenth at times, but I also hesitate when I say it. And that's what I meant when I say, you know, I really am, as an adult, you know, focused on commemorating. It was interesting because last year, in Juneteenth, in the midst of a pandemic, right? I'm so used to every year being able to connect with the community. You know, it's like a family. We get to see folks we haven't seen, you know, for a long time, and the community really just comes together. And obviously we couldn't do that in 2020. So, you know, it was a quiet, you know, commemoration for Juneteenth that year, for me especially, in particular.
Indeed, it's part of the joy of vaccinations, is being able to come together again. In just a few moments, though, tell me something about what is beautiful about Black folk when we are in a space like the Miss Juneteenth pageants. What actually does it feel and smell and sound like to you when you close your eyes and think about it?
Ha, I made a whole movie about it.
I know.
But there, and you know, that's what I was, you know, trying to bring to this film, Melissa, was this sense of joy and this sense of community and, you know, coming together. And this community that I grew up in particular, you know, in Texas, this Black community, you know, there's this sense of, you know, I can smell food when I think about it, barbecue, and there's blues music, and, you know, it's multi-generational, and I can hear children laugh. And so it's just, it's joy. It makes me smile when I think about it.
Channing Godfrey Peoples, screenwriter and director of the film Miss Juneteenth. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Thank you for joining me, Channing. And as always, we want to hear from you. What are you doing to commemorate Juneteenth this year? Give us a call at 877-869-8253 or record your message at 877-869-8253, or you can also send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Okay, folks, that's our show for today, and we hope that you enjoyed it. And I also hope you're staying cool out there. Thanks, as always, for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. And this is The Takeaway.